This morning, my question, would a linebacker by any other name smell as sweaty, plus the Republican obsession with controlling your uterus, and New York's billionaire mayor, an ally or fair-weather friend? But first, President Obama stares down the haters to get a big win. Sitting in this weekend for Melissa Harris Perry. I want to go back to a telling moment with President Obama. The date was April 27th at the Washington Hilton, and the president swapped out the usual hail to the chief for a different kind of entrance.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. How do you like my new entrance music?
Takes a certain kind of chutzpah to swagger into the White House Correspondents' Dinner to DJ Khaled's All I Do Is Win. But from a string of domestic policy victories in the first term to winning re-election by 4.6 million votes, the record is pretty clear. You don't always hear about it in Washington, where people are too busy looking into the mirror to look at history. So let's quickly revisit some of the highlights. This president brought the economy back from the brink through an $831 billion stimulus program, a controversial but ultimately profitable bailout of the American auto industry, strengthening financial reform and creating a dedicated government bureau to protect consumers, that's us, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, reducing criminal injustice by cutting drug sentencing disparities, changing the composition of the Supreme Court by appointing two impressive women, Justices Ilana Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, and of course, the largest progressive domestic policy to expand our social safety net in a generation, the Affordable Care Act. So for Obama supporters who are accustomed to all that, to all those policy successes, so far the second term may seem like it's off to a slow start. But I think that changed this week. The president just took a crucial step towards the first big win of the second term on Tuesday. Advocates for immigration reform broke an attempted filibuster. Now, nothing should stop the Senate from an up or down vote for landmark legislation that would provide the U.S.'s first comprehensive immigration reform in almost three decades. Now, if that happens, President Obama will become the first president to make a lasting mark on immigration policy that clears a way to citizenship for undocumented immigrants since all the way back to 1986. And that, of course, was when President Ronald Reagan passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which took 3 million people who came into America illegally and made them citizens. For President Obama, immigration reform is the ACA of the second term. It's the kind of domestic policy that lifts millions of marginalized people out of legal limbo and enshrines presidential legacies. And now that the president scored a procedural win on the filibuster, Republicans can't stop immigration votes in the Senate. So some are feeling the pressure to play ball, and others, however, have hit on a new strategy, and this is important. They want to amend this bill to death. You've heard Republicans talk about building a wall on the border. Now they have a poison pill set of amendments that would build a wall on the path to citizenship. In fact, there are now 44 amendments that were introduced by our count just in the first 2 hours of Senate floor debate. Now, there's nothing wrong with amendments and, you know, talking through our ideas through the legislative process. That's how things are supposed to work. But some of these Republican amendments are actually designed to sink the entire bill. They would tack on so many hurdles to the citizenship process that many of us think the bill would look a lot more like the status quo than reform. Let's look at some specifics. Take Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. He tried to create a rule that would not allow the legalization process, the whole point of this thing, to begin until the Department of Homeland Security could certify 6 months of control over the U.S. border with Mexico. His Senate colleagues dismissed that out of hand. The measure lost by 14 votes. Then it was Texas Senator John Cornyn's turn. His proposal would hold permanent legal residents hostage for a year until the government's able to confirm a total awareness of everything that happens along the border. Cornyn's trigger would also require a pretty arbitrary border apprehension rate of 90%. Now, mind you, the original bill already includes provisions for increased border security. Federal spending on border security is right now at an all-time high. And the Gang of Eight Senate bill already adds over $4 billion more to that kind of program. So don't think for a second that all these poison pills will go the way of the Grassley Amendment. Once it emerges from the Senate, the immigration bill will still have to survive the House, and that, as we know, is a tougher sell. Republican senators now They're arguing that if the bill has any shot at becoming law of the land, the Senate has to sweeten the deal with these poison pills in order to entice their friends on the House side, the rest of the Republican caucus, to get on board. So ultimately, there is a chance here the president could get his win, but at a price so high, it might not be enough for the very people this president wants to help. Well, at the table with me today, NBC Latino's Paul Reyes, an attorney. I did it again. The reason why I always do that, Raul, it's my second time calling Raul Reyes Paul. It's a teleprompter problem. Raul is an attorney who's been covering this debate, and I'm very excited to have you at the table. We also have Matt Welch, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, which I consider the house journal of the libertarian movement, NYU political science professor Christina Beltran, and Jamal Simmons, who's worked for Bill Clinton, Al Gore, and Max Cleland. Raul, we just talked about everything that is up against this bill, this important Gang of Eight bill. What are the Republicans facing off with this week that we're looking at that's important to distinguish between poison pills and real amendments?
Well, the main thing that's really, I think, will be a turning point is this John Cornyn amendment, because this could give a lot of Republicans cover to not support the bill, because they could say, well, if this is not part of it, then we won't be part of it. But as you pointed out, this Cornyn amendment, this it comes on top of so much border security. But when you really break it down, the big problem with that amendment is that it takes the path to citizenship, it separates it from the people who are actually trying to go through that process. It makes it contingent upon the Department of Homeland Security and other metrics, which can be changed by different administrations or by even perhaps a Republican-appointed DHS secretary. And if the path to citizenship is not secure, if it's not direct, this whole balance of the bill will not work. That's the danger coming ahead.
All right, I want to play something really quick from Jay Carney, who speaks to the point you're talking about, whether that kind of amendment is designed to be a part of immigration reform or something to sink it. Let's take a listen to Jay Carney at the White House on Thursday.
What our goal is, the president's goal is that the Senate keep its eye on the ball and not allow those who clearly have no interest in passing comprehensive immigration reform with all its benefits to the economy and the middle class and our businesses, not allow them to derail this process, but instead to keep focused on a bill that will achieve the principles that the president and the Gang of Eight have laid out.
Christina, you hear Jay Carney, they're talking about derailing the process. Do you think that's what the Cornyn Amendment would do?
I think definitely. I think one of the things that's so interesting is we keep talking about immigration as a complicated issue, and it clearly is. And so one of the problems here is that we're thinking, you know, the Republicans are trying to play politics here as opposed to good policy. So one of the things
that
we keep...
Never.
It's like a magical, strange thing. I can't imagine it ever happening. I think that's really one of the things is the Republicans are trying to give themselves cover by being able to say, well, we just want to make sure we have all these security triggers involved here. But ultimately, it's a completely unrealistic, you know, logic for immigration, and we need to really have complicated conversations about how difficult it is to secure the border, to talk about border security in a realistic way that acknowledges the difficulties of this, but instead we're going to have, you know, potentially incredibly bad policy.
And Matt, when you look at Senator Cornyn's history here, you have someone who's stepping into this debate wanting to play a big role, and yet in 2007, when we had a Republican-backed immigration bill, he demanded concessions and then ultimately didn't get behind the thing. So does that go to whether we should trust him?
He's a politician, so I'm not going to trust him. But I'm not sure that I agree with the framing of the poison pill. I'm not in favor of having some illusory proof of border security before signing up to an immigration bill. It's not my issue. But I've talked to a lot of people who it is their issue. Mm-hmm. They feel like they signed on to this deal by getting enough sort of oral concessions or like promise that they were going to get some kind of certification of security. It's the way it was sort of sold politically to Republicans, and they feel like that the bill as it exists right now doesn't show that, and so it requires this amendment. I think it's an actual philosophical difference. It's one that I don't necessarily agree with, but it's not necessarily intended to sink the bill.
I mean, that's such an important point there, because what you're saying is, even if people are skeptical of the motives of some of these members, and you say we should be skeptical of politicians, always, this is an ingredient that should be a prerequisite, and thus, if it's not, if it doesn't work,
at least a discussion that should be part of it.
I mean, to those people.
Speaking to your point, that we don't have that discussion in this country, that you cannot have a 100% secure border unless you become a police state. No one wants to say that out loud.
Right. Jamal, do you buy that?
Well, let's just first of all realize that Senator Cornyn is like Lucy with the football here. I mean, he is not going to vote for this bill. He didn't vote last time, as you pointed out a second ago. We don't think he's going to do it again. And the border has basically gone to a trickle. I mean, we've got kind of like net zero. Yeah. Of illegal immigration. So I think Republicans are holding this up as really it is politics that they're trying to play with their base constituents. And so maybe they need something that you can give them politically so they can say they did something, but don't let it be something that actually gets in the way of the good policy and ruins them. Ultimately, the Republican Party has to make a decision here. Are they going to be a party that has national ambition, is going to appeal to people across the board and have a chance of winning the White House? Or are they going to be a congressional minority party that can only win because they redistrict everything in a way that they stay in the majority in the House?
Well, and your old boss, former President Bill Clinton, said this week, net zero immigration. Raul, why does that matter here?
It does matter because, first of all, we are doing this at the right time because immigration is at net zero right now. Mexico's economy is growing, so there are far fewer people coming over. But these metrics do matter. And just to your point, Matt, this bill, as it came through the Senate committee, it's already top-heavy with border security provisions. It already allows for, like, the largest increases in border security.
Right,
in
over the $4 billion
in spending. So we're putting that on top of it. And one thing that I think Republicans are missing in this element, they see it this is something maybe they're potentially giving to the Democrats, giving President Obama a win. A poll last week from Latino Decisions showed that the majority of majority of Latino voters would be open to voting for Republicans if they are instrumental in passing this. And half of Latino voters in the past have voted Republican. So the door is open for their own opportunity, and they're not willing to go forward with it. That's part of the story that I think their leadership is missing. It could benefit them.
Right. So you think the dynamics vis-a-vis Republicans are actually in their interest if they were enlightened
right.
to see it.
Right. The opportunity is there.
That's the point I want to stay on. I want to talk about that in our next segment. It's another piece of the puzzle of immigration reform that we think is a little different this time. You're going to have to look at the roll call vote history. That's what we're going to do, and why no one would listen to President George W. Bush. Up next.
Now, this bill isn't perfect. It's a compromise. And going forward, nobody's going to get everything that they want. Not Democrats, not Republicans, not me.
That was President Obama on Tuesday re-entering the fray around immigration reform. The same day, a filibuster-breaking vote in the Senate cleared the way for debate on this bill to truly begin. We are back at the table with some talented panelists. Jamal, you've worked in the Senate for Max Cleland as well as for others. How significant is this week, this breakthrough, breaking what was an attempted Republican filibuster?
Look, this is a big deal. The filibuster has been stymieing legislation piece after legislation piece, and so now we've at least going to get some movement, and we know we're going to get a vote. The president's playing a really deft hand here. I mean, sometimes he speaks up, but mostly the White House has sort of taken a step back, let the Gang of Eight in the Senate kind of work this out to keep the Republicans on the reservation, and we'll see what happens when it gets out of the Senate and goes to the House.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I want to contrast here, and Raul and I have talked about this before, is there are a lot of places where this president's role doesn't get enough credit. We hear a lot of talk about his attitude and his mood and is he strong enough, and that's all sort of adjectives as far as I'm concerned. I want to show you some numbers that show that as a second-term president, this person, Barack Obama, is doing way better than the last president who tried to deal with this. Mm-hmm. I want to look specifically at the 2007 vote to try to break a filibuster against the immigration reform, which was President George W. Bush. He basically went in there and said, we need to do this. And Republicans, only 12, came out and said, okay, let's at least talk about it. By the way, not on the underlying bill of whether we do immigration reform, just to get it to the floor, which, as Jamal was just saying, is the issue. And 37 Republicans in President Bush's own party filibustered him. That's 75% of the Republican caucus. So how significant is it that for a range of reasons, we have a president today who's already done better than that and broken the filibuster?
Right. To me, you know, when you look at the big picture, I've been optimistic about this all along. But when I step back, I still have to say it's extraordinary that we have come so far, that it went through the Senate Judiciary Committee, that it made it through the vote, that we are now, you know, it is now going to the Senate for these weeks. And the thing is, President Obama's role is so interesting because he cannot be too involved because he'll just be a lightning rod for conflict. In some ways, he can do things in public to exert some pressure indirectly. Sometimes he can be sort of a godfather looking over at it, but he's walking a very fine line. And I do give him credit, though, because at certain points, he does, like with the announcement, you know, he does assert himself. Mm-hmm. So he's there. He just cannot be too involved at this point.
Matt, do you agree with that?
I do. And furthermore, I would say that the Republicans, in addition to the fact that Obama has won a couple of elections, which influences people, but he won a couple of elections with increasing support among Latinos, even after setting records for deportations. And there's the young vote right now, which is kind of tied up with a lot of different things. But part of it is the sense that Republicans are the out of touch old white guy party. Right. So, I mean, it's not just Latinos who are voting 70% for Barack Obama and the Democratic Party. It's basically every single group of non-white men right
Jamal,
now.
Jamal, what's your position?
So they're motivated.
Yeah. So, sorry, go ahead, Matt.
The Republicans are motivated right now to deal with this in a way that they weren't in 2006 because they hadn't had their hat handed to them on multiple occasions.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that is really the numbers point here. They went from 75% filibustering a Republican president's immigration reform to going along with this president. So Matt was talking about out of touch old white guys. What is your position on that?
Well, out of touch old white guys. I love them. Some of my best friends are out of touch old white guys. Listen, they're caught in a demographic vice, right? They've got this incredibly shrinking population of people in the South, Midwest, exurbs, and other parts of the country who are, frankly, a little nervous, right? The country's changing around them. The economy has been contracting, so they haven't had the same economic benefits. The country's becoming more brown and more younger, and the values are changing. Gay rights, women are working. I mean, all these things are happening, and they're not quite sure what to do. And I think it's going to be they're going to have to decide when they're going to break from that old group and get to dealing with the new America that's coming.
Yeah, but I think the other thing, though, is, I mean, I want to give credit to Obama for getting things as far as he has. But like you said, a lot of this is about the changing demographics, the election, the fact that Latino voters came out in such high numbers, mm-hmm. and it's really forced the Republicans to think about that fact, or occasionally try to think about that fact. And I think the other part of this that we sort of forget is how important it was that Dreamers and undocumented activists put this on the table last summer when they began, you know, sitting in Obama's campaign offices and saying, we're going to talk about deportation. As you're trying to appeal to Latino voters, we're going to be bringing this up. That was something that mainstream immigrant rights organizations were timid and afraid to do. And so, you know, young undocumented activists put this on the table. And I think that's something that makes this go-round with immigration really interesting, is that we're used to talking about the undocumented. What we're not used to is the undocumented speaking for themselves.
They're not usually part of the conversation.
And now they are themselves organizers.
They have asserted themselves.
Yeah.
They have asserted themselves, as you said, mm-hmm. often against the advice of the more established advocacy organizations. Right. It was 1 year ago today that the president announced the deferred action for young people who are brought here illegally as children. And that, you know, when looking back, that's sort of a turning point in the election, because that's when, you know, Latinos were very disappointed with this president because mm-hmm. of the record deportations, and he had been very recalcitrant on immigration. That was a turning point. And from there mm-hmm. from there on, that's when Latino voters became energized, mobilized, and then it culminated in the, I think it was 71%. Turnout for the president.
Right. Well, and Raul, you mentioned that role, the interplay of the Dreamers, and then people say, well, is the establishment going to embrace that? What's the White House going to do? And at 9:40 a.m. today, they did put out a statement commemorating that one-year anniversary using the language of Dreamers. That's not something that I think was as much a mainstream part of the debate, previously.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about this is we tend to talk about immigrants in terms of what they give us, right? They give, and it's often very instrumental, and it's very much about economics. They give us their labor, labor, they give us their youth, their energy. But what we don't talk enough about is their civic capacity. We're talking about citizenship here, and citizenship isn't just a status, it's a practice, right? And so one of the things that undocumented activism and immigrant activism in general has done is it's shown us people enacting a citizenship they don't yet have.
Yeah, and
that's really powerful.
Right. I want to pick up on that and look at whether that is worth 60 votes or should it be worth 70 votes. That's something we're going to talk about up next on this show. We've got the new standard that the Senate wants to be set and why some of us think it's worse than 60 votes. That's up next. Welcome back. The filibuster-proof 60-vote supermajority has become something of a new normal for passing bills in the Senate, and that is still not enough for some backers of this immigration bill. The Senate Gang of Eight doesn't think 60 votes will be enough to entice Republicans in the House to take action, even if the legislation passes the Senate and that super 60. So, they are ditching the supermajority for an ubermajority, a new number that Gang of Eight member Senator Chuck Schumer spoke about on Meet the Press last week.
We're hoping to get 70 votes, up to 70 votes, which means a lot of Republicans, and we're willing to entertain amendments that don't damage the core principles of the bill, but improve the bill, just as we did in committee. We came out of the committee very strong. Our Gang of Eight stuck together, and we picked up Orrin Hatch's vote as well.
Why stop at 70? Maybe we need 80. Christina, I want to go back to you. We were talking about this before the break. My question is, say what?
I don't really understand. I mean, I think then the terrorists win, right? I mean, I don't really get the logic of sort of thinking, really, do you think like six more votes is going to make, you know, all the sort of Tea Party congressmen go, oh, well, now I'm totally for it. It seems like an insane effort to create a worse bill. Like, it just seems like a recipe for creating the potential for more poor amendments, you know, and
so do you think,
more dangerous.
Do you think Senator Schumer, who people see as an advocate on this, is just strategically wrong?
I think he is. I think the real case is, what is the best policy for immigration, and then making a case for why this is the best policy. Like, we need to fight on the ground of ideas rather than sort of playing politics with assuming that three more votes is going to transform the debate.
Matt, you're friends with libertarians. You've known to consort with the Tea Party.
Unlike Chuck Schumer, yes.
Isn't this the game? I mean, and again, I'm not going to make you defend everything that we think they might want.
Sure.
But it seems to me that this is a crazy game, that we have to go around worrying about what a minority in the Republican caucus, in the House, which has not shown a responsible interest in leadership on this issue, what it would take to get them and build up to 70 now.
Look, do you want a bill? Do you want a law to be passed? Then you're going to have the House of Representatives pass a bill. And they are going to need to feel like they either have political cover for it, or that they're not going to be punished so much politically, or that they are going to be punished so much politically for not passing it. And so I think that's all at Chuck Schumer. And I have never agreed with Chuck Schumer in anything that he's
well, don't
ever
start
said in his
today.
Life. So I'm not going to start today. But I think that's what he's getting at is that, hey, look, if this is going to pass, it can't be like Obamacare. It can't just get over the wire and then have an entire swath of the country be hostile towards this. This has to go a lot stronger.
I would just like to follow kind of the old admonition you get from your parents or your first boss. Under promise, over deliver. So I would like to sort of say, look, let's say 60, and then let's get 70 and have a big showing. Mm-hmm. I'd hate to call 70 and then come in at 68, and everyone now thinks that that's some sort of a defeat.
Well, that Raul, isn't that right? I mean, why give away the leverage? You've got the New York Times today asking whether John Cornyn could be the key vote, which used to be like the key 60th vote, and they're like, he could be the key 70th vote. That's not a thing.
Right. Announcing the strategy is certainly not a good idea. But looking at the bigger picture, to your point about, you know, Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, remember that long amendment process where the Republicans inserted, I think it was 150 amendments to really change the character of that legislation? And they didn't vote for it anyway. So I think there's really a strong case to be made here that it's better to go with a good bill with 60 or 60-some votes rather than something that is an assault on the core of this bill, and the core of this bill is the pathway to citizenship. That is what matters. That's what sets this apart, and that's the balance we're talking about that they constructed going through this whole process. I'm not convinced that the 70 votes is
and
important.
I think there's also another political option for them, which is trying to develop the best bill and fight for it. If you let this get watered down with crappier and crappier amendments, at the end of the day, if the bill does pass and it doesn't work in all these kind of critical ways, and then Democrats Democrats respond by saying, well, we accepted this, you know, this bad amendment. And then actually, you know, it produces a lot of sort of civic frustration of people saying, why can't you guys do this right? You know, at least if Democrats can make an argument that we had a good bill, we did these things. And I think, I mean, I think whether this passes or not, I think the passage is not contingent on this sliver anyway. So it doesn't seem like it's politically that smart, because I think you end up having the healthcare problem where you end up making arguments for a bad bill that you ended up ultimately crediting yourself.
The one question I'll give on that, which is that healthcare is actually a pretty good bill. 30 million people are going to be covered. And so what I would like to, you know, at some point as a practitioner of politics and policy passing, what you want to do is get a bill passed, as we were saying, or as Matt was saying earlier. You want to get a bill passed. And that means sometimes you're not going to get a perfect bill. You're not going to get a great bill, but you're going to get a good bill. And that's going to be good for a lot, much better for a lot more people than having no bill at all.
I've said from the beginning of this that it is a strategic error, I know you guys disagree with me, to make this a comprehensive immigration reform. When you have a situation where there's 10 million people who are lawbreakers, it's time to think about this as a prohibition problem. And there's a way to get at that prohibition problem without throwing the kitchen sink into this. But two generations of reformers have decided that we need it to be comprehensive. The moment that you become comprehensive with it is the moment that you're going to get amendments all over the place. You're going to have so many things that outrage so many people, and so it becomes difficult to pass, and it does get watered down by the structure of the way that it's
I mean, part of the question here is whether it's getting watered down and diluted, or to your point, Christina, whether it's just getting crappier. And making it crappier is different than just making it more watery. And we're going to keep an eye on the crap and the water. What I want to look at next break when we come back is another really important piece, which is you have to understand what triggers mean in this policy and political context and why that gimmick may be catching on with our Congress. It turns out that the budget drama has some lessons for the immigration reform advocates. If this, then that. That's how policy triggers are supposed to work. So if a sequence of border security measures are in place, then the path to legal citizenship opens up for America's undocumented immigrants. And that might be a reasonable approach to public policy for some people. Except when we're left stuck with a trigger that becomes bigger than the policy itself. I think we need to look no further for an example than the trigger that was never supposed to happen. Remember this moment from a presidential debate last October?
The sequester's not something that I proposed. It's something that Congress has proposed. It will not happen.
But it did happen. The threat of automatic spending cuts was supposed to force Congress to take action to reduce the deficit. Instead, we got what we're stuck with and struggling with now, a seemingly permanent sequestration. Now, Jamal, I bring up the sequester because it was a type of trigger, and I think it's absolutely clear from the record that the president was not interested in going over that cliff. In fact, he went more than halfway to be reasonable, to do outreach, to be bipartisan.
Sure.
And the very thing that he and others had said, we don't want, John Boehner wrote in the Wall Street Journal, we don't want this to happen, became the policy. Should we be worried about that here as we look at all of these triggers?
Well, the question for me is going to be, you know, the Gang of Eight, does it stick, does it keep some of these dangerous amendments out? And then you mentioned a name that we have not heard enough about, John Boehner. You know, what about John Boehner's leadership here? He's
really, I kind
of
feel like I hear about him all the time.
Really? What are you watching? here? You know, John Boehner's house is going to have to pass this. He's the speaker. So the question is he going to be able to exert the leadership to get his party to do what the majority of Americans want? And that needs to be on his shoulders.
So, Matt, that goes to part of the policy discussion we were having earlier, which is what kind of triggers do you think are fair and reasonable to include? Clearly, many Republicans and even some libertarians rejected Grassley's approach because it seemed like a poison bill pretending to be a trigger. How can we be sure that the alternatives are more real?
I think it's all going to be in this sort of muddy zone between having DHS, you know, say, I think we got it under control. I think Cornyn wants a 90% rate of catching illegal immigrants on the border. I think that's probably a non-starter. So they're going to try to find some way for a mushy cover that doesn't actually require any hard trigger, is what I guess, because you can't actually measure this and lock it down.
What I'm struck by is that this whole idea of triggers in a way reflects a kind of a fundamental lack of trust in our ability to govern.
Exactly.
I mean,
yes,
it really does.
Exactly.
Fundamentally, we're like, we can't
An
do
understandable
this.
Understandable lack of trust.
You know?
Right.
But in some ways, like, you cannot make a machine that runs itself. Like, at some point, you actually need judgment and assessment and on-the-ground fluidity where you can make choices, and you can't escape that. And triggers, you know, produce some incredibly destructive policies, and so it actually, and it works actually in the opposite sense. What has the sequester done but erode people's sense the government can work? So it produces the very thing it doesn't want.
Well, and Raul, doesn't that go to the real, the deeper policy question Christina's raising, which is when the Patriot Act was first passed, there was a trigger of sorts called technically a sunset, but the idea was that after 10 years, we must redebate this because it will expire. We must. Mm-hmm. And there was actually agreement, interestingly, across the left and the right, both in passing that thing, which turned out to have, I think, some bad ingredients, but also with that approach of saying, give us 10 years. Mm-hmm. Is that logic really applicable to a situation where a lot of people, including American businesses, seem to say we need to deal with undocumented immigration regardless of what happens?
Right. And also, there are so many variables in this equation. You know, how the Mexican economy is doing, how that affects our you know, the flow of illegal undocumented immigrants into this country, you know, the needs of our labor market, you know, whoever is in power, whoever happens to be which person from which party is appointed DHS secretary. And the problem, you know, I certainly support various metrics to have different levels of border security. The problem is what we've seen in past attempts at border security, the Republicans keep changing those metrics. In fact, going back to the 2007 attempt at immigration reform, pretty much all of those metrics that they had then for border security have been met or surpassed. But now that we're talking about illegal immigration again, now those are not good enough. They have put them further, although, as we talked about, illegal immigration is down. So it's just a very fine line. But
we have to go because we're about to talk about prison reform. I want to give the last word to Jamal. Do the Republicans move the goalposts?
Oh, yeah, they move them every time. And there's one more thumb on the scale, though, I want to say before we go, which is the technology community, Silicon Valley, wants to get this done to get those H-1B visa numbers up.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you to Matt Welch and Jamal Simmons. Christina and Raul will be back later in the program. We are going to look at a new Republican effort to regulate women's bodies. I think you need to see this. But first, there are a lot of apologists out there for the Washington Redskins. I want to call a bull on a very important one, my letter to the commish. That's up next. Anything less than the best is a felony. Love it or leave it. You better gain weight. You better hit bulls out of kid. Don't play. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook.